Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. Tonight, my guests in studio are artist, printmaker, teacher, Nancy Diesner. I'm so glad it rhymes with Harry Reisner. And back again, it's always a pleasure to talk to him. David Wackel.
Hello, sir.
And you are from the visual artist. You're from the Department of Art and Music. You're an administrator, a lecturer, and a preparator at Anna Maria College.
That's right.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of hats. I'm working on consolidating the title.
Make it an anagram or something.
Sir.
Really?
Do an exhibit, actually a couple of times at the gallery.
That's really fascinating. Okay, that's a whole other conversation that we need to have. Do they do shows regularly?
Yes.
I need to cover the next show. I need to have some of the monks. Wait a minute. Do they get to talk about their work?
They do.
Okay.
Yes.
Because I thought they took a vow of silence.
Maybe some of them were during the day, but
all right.
I know some gregarious monks.
So this is a fascinating show. Now, Nancy, I was talking to David before he came down here, and he says, you don't want to talk about this as like an installation. Would you say it's an installation?
Well, it's beginning to feel, as I'm finishing the work up for the show, it is beginning to actually feel more like an installation.
Is that and you've done installation work before, which I've seen pictures.
A little bit, but I wouldn't say that's really, you know, sort of what I do. I'm a very 2D person. I sometimes think I can't even like see in 3D, although I love sculpture. But this particular exhibition, because of the content and kind of where it's going, it does have this kind of cohesive whole in the room. And that's such a beautiful gallery at Anna Maria. I was surprised when I saw it the first time.
So would you call it a site-specific?
It's going to end up being somewhat site-specific, yeah, because of those tall ceilings there and the sort of the almost ship-like shape.
Wow.
I would say.
Yeah. Now, you do a variety of printmaking. And we'll talk about the techniques in a bit. Let's talk about this specific show.
Okay.
This has to do with you sculling?
Yes.
That's the inspiration for it. When did you start sculling?
So I started, I was not an athlete. I started sculling when I was, 4 years ago when I was 56. I took a sculling class because that was the year that we had that horrible winter and they didn't know when the ice was going to come out of the Charles River.
Right.
And so I got this discounted sculling one class and I didn't want to. Rowing, crew rowing is with a lot of people in the boat. And I don't want to be with a lot of people. I wanted to be in my own boat. So I took sculling. And the moment I got in that boat, I loved it. And it's just been this, it's so rich and it's so, there's so much meaning in it beyond just, you know, doing this beautiful motion down the river, that it's inspired me on all sorts of levels. And the year after I started sculling, I scull at community rowing in Boston, CRI. It's the biggest club, I think, in the country, possibly. But
and you're sculling there. On the Charles?
On the Charles.
Okay.
Yeah, and they were getting rid of all their old boats, and they brought in these new beautiful boats, you know, racing shells, and they sold off all their old boats, and I bought this old part wood boat, and I restored
it.
With the help of the boatmen, the guys in the boat repair bay at CRI. For I think 6 months over the starting in the winter, they sort of I would say, Dave, what's the next step?
Wait a minute. Yeah. Oftentimes I have people who just sort of waft over things like David and the monks. So you actually helped restore the boat.
I didn't help restore it. I restored it. I mean the guys in the boat bay and I also connected with the guy who built it.
That sounds like a major project.
I know, but I'm an artist. Like I just thought, oh, I can do this. This doesn't look difficult. It's 9 inches wide and 26 feet long. So it feels like a body, a tall body, granted, but...
Can you carry that by yourself?
It's 30 pounds.
It's very, very light.
Very light, yeah. Racing shells are very light. They're long, but they're very light.
I grew up in Watertown on the banks of the Charles.
That's just where...
I know, and I've seen sculling all the time. And sculling to me always seemed magical because... It seems like almost minimal contact with the water when you're using the oars, and you're just gliding weirdly. It's like no other boat I've ever seen on the water. It's almost like you're skating on the surface of the water.
Backwards. Yeah, and it's like a dragonfly in the water in a way, like just something that's
the
so
long body.
Light. Yeah. And it's this beautiful tension between, it's very, you know, you're always afraid you're going to flip because these boats just, there's nothing to keep them upright, really, except you.
And that means you would fall into the Charles.
Yes.
Not a good thing.
Which everyone does, but you have to be very relaxed to do the stroke well.
So you have to be centered.
Yes, and mindful.
And mindful.
And aware of your body and aware of your surroundings with equal attention. It's like life, the difficulty and the struggles of life, that tension with relaxation, that awareness with self-awareness, you know, awareness of your environment and also tremendous internal awareness. And the thing that was inspiring for the work that's in this show, which are all boats cast from this boat that I restored, is that the water becomes, it's dark water, I mean, the Charles, you know.
Yeah, it's very, a lot of tannins in the water.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of stuff in there. You can't really see into it. It's like your subconscious. And then around you is this, you know, the world of light, your conscious. And it's always this fear of flipping, but into your subconscious. But everyone knows.
So it's the fear of loss of conscious control?
Right. But at the same time, there's so much in there, so much primitive, primal sort of urges and realities, which is very much the Charles River.
What I read in your interview with David is that you talked about all of a sudden seeing something like a great blue heron.
Yeah.
And then that sort of changes your whole relationship to what you are in the boat and what you're doing.
Absolutely.
You're all of a sudden grounded in part of a natural environment. You start to, that tells you that.
Right. Even though it's the Charles River, which is this urban river.
And it's a lot cleaner than it used to be. I grew up with it in the 50s when it was a disaster.
Uh-huh.
Now, hearing you talk about it, it seems if you're a visual artist, there is no way you can avoid not trying to do something with that experience.
Yeah, definitely.
Talk to me about the materials you're using in this show.
So the boats, I'm actually casting them. The boat that I restored is actually not the boat I regularly row anymore. I row a really nice, fast racing shell that's all carbon fiber and gorgeous. But the old boat that I restored, I'm casting in paper. I've cast in paper. I've got about five of them that will be in the show. And then I work images on the inside of that paper boat.
Now, are these images like your prints?
They are my prints, yeah.
Okay.
And then the material that I used when I restored the boat for the decking is this, they don't use it anymore, but it's this fabric that's just translucent. It's beautiful. So you can kind of see the wood inside the boat of those old boats. I'm using that. There are images. I print images that you can print on it. I print images on it, and then I heat seal it, and it stretches to this tight drum. And so those images are also translucent, so you can see through them into the bottom of the boat where all these other images are. So there are a lot of levels going on, but like I said, I'm not three-dimensional. It's a very 2D, in a weird way, experience, even though that the hull shape is concave.
It's funny that you say that you're two-dimensional, because when I've looked at some of your prints, they seem so layered. There seem that there's a lot of different layers to them that they don't seem 2D.
Yeah, they're right. That's true. I think, I guess when I say 2D, I think of layered space.
Right.
Not... you know,
well, the object itself may be 2D, but right. The space that you're representing is... Now, how long have you been making prints?
Since I was 15.
And you've gravitated to several different techniques. For instance, you do photopolymer printmaking. And what does that involve?
That's a photo-based etching process.
Wow.
So it's a fairly new process to kind of... The old way of making, you know, photo-based prints was somewhat toxic, photogravure.
And that's a big issue for you.
Yes, it is. This is not completely non-toxic. You're dealing with polymers,
right.
But it's a lot less toxic. So, but what I end up with is an etching that I then wipe the same way as you know, traditional etchings are wiped and printed. And
you seem to keep up with techniques in printmaking. And for instance, you also do digital image manipulation and else. So there's a whole evolution of your printmaking techniques, would you say, if I were to look at your body of work over time?
Well, when I found photopolymer, I just fell in love with it. And I just...
So you found... Do you feel like it was that thing that you'd always been looking for?
Yeah, kind of. Actually, my degrees are in painting. I always did prints, but my undergrad and grad degrees are painting.
Okay, wait a minute. What were your paintings like?
They were very two-dimensional. They were like Russian icons. I mean, that's the best way. Like, layered in that way. And I was very... They were big and on board. You know, like Mason writers. Figurative.
Okay.
But I was very interested in...
Natural history subjects, like a lot of your prints have?
Not as much. They were figurative, like bodies.
Okay.
And they were very much kind of about that space that Russian icons have, where when you look at a Russian icon, the idea was you're staring... You know, you're having this spiritual relationship with the subject. You're entering that space on some other level or plane. And that's what I wanted in a really different way. They were also like this body of work inspired by poetry. Some of the German, Georg Trakl, different poets, Hölderlin, were really inspirational for me. And so a lot of those paintings were about that.
Are the spiritual aspects of this very important to you? They seem to occur organically. I mean, it's not like it's a forced... thing, but the more I hear you talk, the more I hear that you're trying to go beyond always in your work to something else.
Yeah, I think that's really, really true. I think a lot of printmakers come from an illustration background.
Yeah,
and there's always sort of a clear message and a clear visual composition. You know, it's very strong. And I'm constitutionally not made that way. So I always feel like I'm that other kind of printmaker that's kind of coming from painting, and everything's like really layered and really dense and not clear and really hard to talk
about.
No,
you're all about the what the Greeks used to call monstrous, where two things are joined together and you're not sure whether it's bad or good or what. And it's funny because I just did an interview about the spirituality of that last week about pantheism. Huh. And that sort of that twilight zone sort of like where you can't quite, it's not obvious, and it could be many things or.
Right.
That seems, when I looked at your animal prints, it was like there was a lot of things going on.
Right. They're dead, but they're alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's. Definitely, I'm interested in that ambiguity. I'm not interested in direct messaging.
You're not didactic in the least.
No.
Okay.
No. It would come in handy if I could be. But
talk to me about your relationship to the natural world too, because I feel really strongly when I look at your prints that there's a really interesting thing that you're expressing. It's complex, but I just wanted to talk to you. I mean, what do you get from the natural world?
Well, I grew up in the summers. My parents had a cabin that, you know, we were sort of just left. Like, I always imagine I was just running around in, like, nothing, just kind of, like, sort of left free. So I had one of those childhoods,
but that's
only in the summer.
That's a great childhood, though.
It was good in the sense of developing a connection to the natural world.
Yeah.
And we always had dogs and things like that. But I think that's always been, that has always been a really strong connection. And in my work for many years, it's been about animals.
But not just animals, but you write about, I think, in one of your statements about the connections of humans and animals.
Right, exactly. Like both things, like the fact that we can feel so connected, like to a domestic animal, a dog or a cow even, looking in their eyes. But at the same time, we're not. I mean, we also are very separate from, you know, wild animals and domestic animals.
But we have that illusion that we're making a connection.
We can, yeah. But what I find beautiful is that it's both. We're living with these alien creatures, and yet we still find meaning in them, whether it's taking a hyena and making a symbol out of it for the way it acts and behaves, or if we're just seeing its wildness as something so separate, but on some deep level we can connect with it. You know, as creatures on the earth, you know. But where was I?
I think you were talking about the connection between humans and animals and your spirituality of your work, which is not didactic. It's much more complex, much more subtle. But it's because our relationship to the natural world is subtle or complicated, I should say, not subtle.
Yeah.
And that a lot of times we can't put a finger on what exactly is going on. When I'm outside and I start to have a certain kind of feeling that's being produced by the environment, I can't quite talk about it. There's a Zen koan that says as soon as you name something, you've lost it.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So that you don't want to be didactic about it. You can only express it in certain ways.
Right, exactly. And I think getting back to those wild animals that you were talking about, that body of work was very much about...
beautiful pieces, by the way,
oh,
but also strange.
Well, yeah, a lot of people are freaked out by them because they're dead animals. I mean, they're taxidermied animals.
Oh, yeah.
Put in poses of, you know, live animals. And
like John James Audubon did.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so there's this, a lot of people are put off, though, because you can tell that they're dead. But what I'm trying to do in the work is on some level...
reanimate them?
Yeah. Sort of give them not an obvious context for life, but a feeling that they're
very Frankensteinian.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of, I guess.
And I mean that in the best possible way. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest today is artist, printmaker, teacher, Nancy Diesner. And also in the studio, David Wackel. He's a friend of the station. He's been down here many times. He is the administrator, lecturer, and preparator at Anna Maria College's classes and galleries. And her show, which again, you gotta, I'm gonna ask you to talk about the reference point for this. Nancy's show is called "All I Want Is to Be the River, Though I Return Again and Again to the Clouds." And when's that show gonna be again?
That will be on February 20th. That's when we have our opening.
And talk about when the opening's gonna be.
So the opening's February 20th from 5 to 7.
Yep.
And we'll have refreshments and that type of thing. But one of the highlights for me of the opening is a discussion between the gallery director, Dalla Matsumoto, and the artist. So
excellent.
We'll have another chance to talk to Nancy. Yeah.
Nancy, talk to me about that quote. As soon as I read that, it really just transported me into the meaning of that, that here you are situated in the river, which is what you want to be. You want to be the river. You want to flow
right
to the sea.
Right.
But then you keep getting lost in the clouds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now
it's a line from a poem by Cary Fountain. The title of the poem is "Time to Be the Fine Line of Light."
Oh,
and
wow.
It's just gorgeous. It's just, I agree. It just transported me the first time. And it said so much about, you know, sort of being in the now, but also seeing this other larger sort of sense of time and space unfolding that you're also a part of.
And here's the amazing thing. That's the title of your show, but I ended up getting so lost in the title. You know, I started thinking about, well, rivers are very actually contained because you've got two banks on either side of the river. But when you're looking at clouds just change and disappear and appear at whim. And so they're very different. They're uncontained.
Right, right. That's
and
true.
So you're caught between the two realms while you're out there in your skull.
And also the and the river is so much, is this, again, that dark,
it's very seductive.
Moving, right, that body of water that's
right.
Dark and moving. And the clouds are up there, you know, and it's, you know, up versus down. I just, you know, and the idea, I also think that, you know, in part maybe what I see in that line is this idea of, you know, being attached to this flow, just being attached to it, but you just keep dissolving into this, you know, this other, this sort of umbrella over everything. And I just think that those two, thinking in that way is really beautiful and is a lot about what I think about when I'm sculling, you know, just that movement, you know, it's very rhythmic. And it's so visually beautiful.
I have to believe more than any other kinds of boating that you feel like you're part of the river.
Yeah, I think
because
that's really true.
Going with the flow, minimal disturbance of the water, and therefore you're just flowing with it.
Right, right. Just skating along that surface. Yeah.
Talk to me about Dog's Eye Print Studio.
So in 2010, I left college teaching. I'd been teaching full time for 17 years.
How did your work do while you were teaching?
Well, that's I would work in the summers.
You didn't have time.
It's not even time for me. It is true. I didn't have time, but it was also attention. I'm not a multitasker. I can't jump. When May would come, we'd have graduation. I'd get back in my studio and all of a sudden my sense of time would go to what I naturally go to, which is just a much slower.
And no deadlines.
Yeah. And then August would hit and, you know, then everything falls apart again. But I left teaching because I was teaching in New Hampshire, and I'd been commuting a lot, and it started getting to my body and my car and everything else. But coincidentally, at the same time, my mother passed away, and I inherited a little bit of money that allowed me to renovate the barn in back of our house into a printmaking studio. And so that's what Dog's Eye Print Studio is. I originally had thought I have a couple of presses, and so I was going to rent time to other artists to work on the presses. But it ended up, people hired me to make these photopolymer plates for them, and that really is actually what Dog's Eye Print Studio became, is that I make plates for other artists. I do some printing for other artists. And the teaching actually happens more out at ZMA's printmaking in Northampton, Mass.
You also do artist books.
I used to, yeah. It's so interesting because...
Because I was looking at those, and they were really fascinating.
I used to feel so connected. Like, that was the only... You know, it just felt like opening a book, that relationship you have to a book, and a book of images was just so central. And I've lost that now. I actually have no interest in making artist books right now. I don't know what happened.
Well, part of that is... I think that's part of the natural evolution of being an artist, because... I think people who aren't visual artists don't understand how artists work, but you don't get stuck in one thing. If you do, it's a problem.
It's, a problem. Yeah.
It's like, yeah, if you're like 70 years later and you're still painting the same thing or doing the same way, it's not that great a thing. Mm. And as new materials and new experiences come to you, you're going to change.
Right, exactly.
But you don't have any interest in doing the books.
I don't. I love looking at them. I have to say, I have a lot of friends who are book artists, and I just, you know, it's magic.
I love books.
Oh, yeah. It's such an interesting combination.
It is.
So varied. But not anymore. Yeah.
Did I see a photograph of an installation of yours that had these big globes or?
Yes, those pods.
Talk to me about those.
Those are actually precursors of the boats because they're made in this similar way.
Yeah, exactly.
Paper pods.
There were snakes on the inside of one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. There were lots of animals. Those. They're, again, that whole two-dimensional and three-dimensional thing. The prints are inside this concave form.
Not on the outside like you would expect.
Right, exactly. So you just see these pods swinging.
Well, those are weird in and themselves. They're pretty alien.
Yeah, they are a little bit.
The fact that you call them pods really is reminiscent of 1950s science fiction movies.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
except what's in there is maybe a little more benign than...
Well, when you look in them, they have a hole, mm-hmm. and you can see inside them. It's a very strange experience because they're distorted differently than you expect.
The space is really weird. I don't even know how to... And it's a little like this concave space inside these boats I'm
looking at. Yeah,
even more so because it was so... You know, it was curved at every spot. And so working on those was so interesting. I had to keep... You know, I'd have to keep... They were made over... Some of them were made over balloons. Others were made over bigger sort of round of inflatable things. And I had to keep deflating and inflating because I had to keep looking at how things... were taking shape in there in this way that I couldn't retain.
It's so much, I know, because
the space was so strange.
Most people would expect, like, you're in a globe, it's on the outside of the curve.
Right.
Trying to do something on the inside of a globe, I was just trying to figure out how you did it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was it. I had to keep inflating.
Did you have to stick your head in there?
No, I could look. I could look pretty. I mean, the openings are big enough for you to look. But
right.
It was...
Lighting them must be weird.
That was really beautiful and unexpected. I didn't know that the lights would, you know, they're on these strings. The pieces are on the strings from the ceiling, and it's translucent paper, so they would swing just with the air in the room.
Wow.
And it was so beautiful, and they'd cast these shadows, and they'd become translucent, like almost like, again, those eggs from science fiction where you can kind of see something moving inside. That was a shock. I hadn't anticipated that. So the first time I hung them, it was really wonderful.
Can you see yourself now with that and now the skulls, like continuing in for at least a couple of years on putting the prints on forms like that?
Well, I what's hard about this, I don't know what to do with them when I'm done. You know, you have to store them. This is the problem with 3D.
Again, this is another problem that people don't realize about artists.
Yeah,
they just sort of think everything's sold and you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, and that never, at least for me, that very, very, very rarely happens. But
you have to put them somewhere.
I was trying to think, you know, could I fold these? But I keep coming back to this working on unusual surfaces.
That's what I'm asking.
Surfaces. So I don't know. I never know how long these connections are going to last. But this one feels like there's just, it feels like there are worlds of imagery and you know, feelings and sensations that I want to express through this boat form, the shell.
Is there any sense of bringing them down to the river?
Yeah, I had sort of wondered about that. You know,
I had a feeling you would wonder about that.
I think that would be really interesting.
I'm completely unsurprised.
I read somewhere that early, at one point, you know, back in the days when rowing was a popular sport in this country, that some of the shells used to be made out of paper, and the idea was they would just be, they were so light and you could go so fast that they just would be used once. I'm not sure that's true. I may have dreamt that, but it's a really lovely idea.
It's a great idea. I think you dreamt it, though.
Although yeah, I've never seen a picture of one.
So. Yeah, but it makes total sense, though, because it would be very light. You'd probably coat it with something like wax or something like that. No, not wax, but shellac.
There are, you know, kayaks that are made out of paper.
Well, think about birch bark canoes. That's pretty close to paper.
Right, exactly.
So it's totally feasible. Yeah. We're completely out of time.
Oh.
I know. And people need to see this. People need to see this show. So, David.
February 20th. 5 to 7, come to the opening, meet Nancy.
Nancy, then, I want you to say the name of the show, the title.
All I want is to be the river, though I return again and again to the clouds.
Beautiful. My guest tonight in studio has been artist, printmaker, teacher, Nancy Diesner. Show of her work is going to be at Anna Maria. Don't miss this show. And then David Wackel. Administrator, lecturer, and preparator. Thank you so much for bringing the artist down.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
This is Mark Lynch. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. Good night.